Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Refinancing your car at Kemba Financial Credit Union can get you quick access to cash to help manage high-rate debts and expenses. Get up to $500 next day cash back, plus no payments for 90 days, and take cash equity out. Make your car work for you and drive away with extra cash. Apply at Kemba.org. Restrictions apply. Offer ends April 30th, 2024. Federally insured by NCUA.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. Robert, what's the weirdest thing you ever got stuck up your nose?
Ooh, I think I've been very fortunate. I know plenty of other people who have tales of siblings getting odd objects lodged up their nostrils, be it a marble, or I think my brother-in-law had a piece of carpet stuck up there or something. You know, you hear all these stories, and luckily, I don't think I've ever had anything stuck in my nose. So I'm fortunate in that regard.
You know, your mention of the marbles makes me think about, did you ever see that old episode of the show Home Movies where their take on the like Judas Priest subliminal messages thing is there's a rock band who I think does a public service announcement song called Don't Put Marbles in Your Nose, but it also keeps saying put them in there.
No, I think the worst, especially like childhood experience of anything going into an unexpected orifice would be when I had some sort of small insect fly into my ear.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Which the main distressing thing is that a little bug, once it gets inside your ear, is extremely loud.
Yes.
So I do remember that quite clearly.
It's looking at the outside from the inside. It's a horrible feeling.
Yeah. And I remember like my dad was there and he jumped in. And I guess it happened at the house because they had some like rubbing alcohol. Mm-hmm. And like they poured a little bit of that into my ear and that took care of it.
Well, that experience is going to be a great jumping off point for our discussion today, because I think we should start off by playing one of my favorite games that we play on this show, which is go into old medical journals and read some weirdness.
Oh, yes.
So I want to talk about a case report that was published in December of 1830 in the medical journal The Lancet. This is a truly disturbing report, so if you get icked out easily, fair warning. So let us read from The Lancet. A farmer's wife, 28 years of age, residing in the neighborhood of Metz, had for a long time been affected with an unpleasant itching sensation in the nose with coryza, which means a runny nose, to which symptoms in the year 1827, violent headache acceded, so that she was at length obliged to apply for medical aid. The headache was irregularly intermittent and generally began at the root of the nose and the middle of the forehead, or at the right frontal region, extending this fence, first to the right side and then over the whole head. The attack was accompanied by a great discharge of tears, and sometimes even nausea and vomiting. The features were forcibly distorted, the jaws firmly closed, and the eyes and ears so very sensible that she could not bear the least light or any noise. At other times she became delirious, pressed the head between her hands, and ran about in a state of distraction. The pain was, according to her statement, like the strokes of a hammer, or as if something was perforating the skull, and the fits generally returned about 12 times in 24 hours. Sometimes the headache continued uninterruptedly for several days. The coryza, or runny nose again, existed during the whole period, and the discharge was occasionally very fetid and mixed with blood. Okay, so we're starting off pretty gross already. This poor woman is suffering these terrible chronic symptoms. She's got the headache, she's got the swelling, she's got the sensitivity in the eyes and the nose and all that. And then she's also got this discharge mixed with blood. It's always distressing in any case to have fetid discharge.
Yeah, the idea that it's fetid is very worrisome.
Okay, so continuing. Some medicines were employed, but no regular plan of treatment was followed, and it was not before a 12-month suffering that this singular affection terminated after the expulsion of a worm from the nose, which moved with rapidity and when placed in water remained alive for several days. It was afterwards killed by being put in alcohol and then sent to Monsieur Marechal, who reported the case to the society. He found the animal to be more than 2 inches in length and one line in breadth, and I looked that up. Apparently a line is a unit of measure that was not very well standardized. It probably means like a tenth of an inch or a twelfth of an inch, so not very wide, but 2 inches in length. It had two antennae.
So not a proper worm.
Right, not a proper worm. Was of yellowish color, flat, and consisted of 64 rings, on each of which were two legs. So definitely not a worm. Monsieur Marechal subsequently transmitted the insect to Messieurs Hollandre and Roussel, who ascertained that it was a Scolopendra electrica.
Okay, so if it had two legs per segment.
Yeah.
That sounds an awful lot like a centipede.
Right you are, Robert. This is a centipede we're talking about. This report alleges that this woman had this chronic condition for more than a year, which was alleviated when she finally blew a centipede out of her nose.
Still, that's got to be pretty satisfying.
Yeah. Yeah, talk about what is the – is there a word for that, the psychological thing where like people are obsessed with like removing objects from their body, the satisfaction people get from like picking a huge booger from pooping a large poop?
I don't know, but – or popping a pimple.
Yes, that too. Yeah.
Yes, I thought about this on and off for years, and I would love to explore it in an episode if there is enough material out there about it, because clearly – it is an obsession. Like there are whole video channels on YouTube associated with this sort of thing. And I when I hear people talk about, oh, imagine the virtual realms will happen in the future.
Right.
And I'm thinking, well, yes, you're going to have your obvious sex and violence oriented experiences, but there are going to be like whole virtual realms devoted to the popping of surrealistic pimples.
Yeah, what is the Grand Theft Auto of like visceral body purging experiences?
Yeah.
Before I forget, I do want to give a hat tip because I came across this story on the blog of a British writer named Thomas Morris, who covers a lot of horrifying medical history and is definitely worth following if you're interested in this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So shout out to Morris, who we will return to again in a minute. But anyway, back to the centipede coming out of the nose. So there are probably some good reasons to question the details of this report, right? Just because it was published in a medical journal like The Lancet doesn't mean it's necessarily true, especially this far back in history. But we can come back to that. So the insect alleged here is not actually an insect. It is a centipede. It's the Scolopendra electrica, a reportedly bioluminescent centipede, according to a catalog by Bozard in Nature in 1896, quote, a well-known luminous insect, again, not an insect, but well-known luminous insect whose light is but rarely seen owing to the insect living underground and in manure heaps.
Okay, so that's how it would have seen what it was doing. Up in her sinuses.
Maybe that's how it ended up there. Like she was snorting manure. There you go. But the bottom line is this report is that a woman had a glowing centipede living in her nose for over a year.
Which is a bit far-fetched.
Yeah, I think so. But I mean, it's impossible to know for sure, but I have a lot of doubts. But yeah, so I wanted to explore more, and then later we'll get into the more general territory, I think, of creepy crawlies getting into body orifices. And I think we're going to be focusing primarily not on things that are, say, obligate parasites, because that's a more trodden ground, right? You might understand why, like, say, a leech could get into the human anus because it's seeking that kind of environment.
Right. Or certainly endoparasites that even if they're not – I mean, certainly there are plenty of human endoparasites, but there also are endoparasites of other species that can end up in our bodies.
Yeah.
And even though they are not at home here, this home is very much like the home they desire.
Right. So we're not so much talking about like hookworms, tapeworms, human botflies and all that, which we have discussed in other episodes. But we're talking more today about creatures that don't need to be in the human body and wouldn't normally seek it out, but somehow they at least reportedly end up there. So coming back to the Scolopendra, centipedes of the genus Scolopendra can be truly awesome predators. They tend to step over what is for me one of the most shocking and unpleasant of lines, which is when invertebrates prey on vertebrates.
That's
something about that always feels backwards and scary and not okay.
I mean, part of it perhaps is that, and I feel like this is a kind of an undercurrent to this earlier example, is that invertebrates will undoubtedly feast upon vertebrates.
Right.
Like, you know, they are
like
some of
carrion,
the they're going to be some of the primary devourers of our deceased form. And certainly older generations that were more associated and more closely aligned with physical death, they would have witnessed this more often, both in the bodies of animals, but also in human bodies from time to time.
But I'm talking about predation.
You're talking about outright killing, which seems like they have crossed a line, like the line being you shalt eat us when we are dead, but thou shalt not do the killing.
Right. It's supposed to be like humans eating lobsters, not lobster cousins eating human cousins. I mean, that is clearly verboten, but it's just not. It's just not verboten. It happens in nature, and there are examples of Scolopendra that do this. So according to a 2005 article in the Caribbean Journal of Science by Molinari et al., quote, Scolopendrid centipedes prey on frogs and toads up to 95 millimeters long, small lizards, snakes up to 247 millimeters long, birds up to the size of a sparrow, and both field and house mice. So you've got some centipedes in this genus that are getting down on birds, they're getting down on mice, but presumably due to size restrictions, I think if there are actually any cases of scolopendrids getting in people's noses, it's going to be not the ones that twist their many-legged bodies around mice and sparrows and eat their warm-blooded mammal flesh, right? That those would probably be too big to end up in the nasal cavity. Now, back to Thomas Morris, the medical history writer who brought this case to my attention on his blog. He writes in his blog post that he thinks it's unlikely that the centipede would have survived inside the woman's nasal sinuses for as long as the report alleges, which is more than a year. And I think that's – I don't know. It's one of those things where it's hard to know for sure, but that does seem like a likely objection to throw, right?
Right.
It's like, what would it be eating in there? Could it really like survive in there that long without getting blown out or killed in some other way?
Yeah, it just doesn't seem sustainable.
On the other hand, the report is detailed. It's published in a reasonably reliable source. It does seem to be reported by a physician. It just seems sort of inherently unlikely. Then again, you know, there are all kinds of things we could go to. We can talk in a minute about the possibility of hoaxes, of confusion. I mean, what if just like a centipede happened to get up in her nose during the last day or so of an otherwise bad nose inflammation period? That also seems unlikely, but eh. So, this is not the only reported case of a centipede up the nose. In fact, I came across a totally separate case from an old medical archive, also dug up by Thomas Morris on his blog. This was several years ago. This is from the first volume of Medical Essays and Observations published in 1764. So here's this case. Quote, A woman of good heel constitution, meaning she was healthy, about 36 years old, began to complain of a fixed pain in the lower and right side of her forehead. During the last 2 years, this pain became continual, accompanied with convulsions, often depriving her of both her reason and rest. She was 2 or 3 times brought to death's door by it. At the end of 4 years, after trying several medicines to no purpose and despairing of any relief and yet not knowing what to do, she took to taking rapee snuff, so it's like tobacco snuff. She had not taken this snuff for a month, when behold, seized one morning with a fit of sneezing and blowing her nose after, to her great surprise, she found a worm rolled up in a little blood. This worm, when stretched to its full length, was 6 inches long, and but 2 when it contracted itself. It was 2 lines broad and 1.5 thick, of a coffee color, convex on one side and flat on the other. It was of the centipede kind and had 56 feet on each side. It had 2 eyes, and both its head and tail were armed with 2 forks. It lived 18 hours in an empty bottle and 3 or 4 hours after brandy had been put to it. The egg that produced this worm, in all probability, was sucked in along with the air she breathed and carried after to the frontal sinus, where it met with a proper nidus, meaning nest, to give it both growth and increase.
All right. Well, at least we have a hypothesis here of how it could have wound up there, right?
Maybe. I mean, that seemed – well, she sucked in the egg somehow and it hatched in there. That also – I don't know. I'm not a centipede expert. This seems a little bit unlikely, but
or it sounded like the implication here was that it might the egg might have been in the snuff. At any rate, there's at least an attempt at explaining how it wound up in there. It's not like, oh, God has put a centipede in thy head.
Right.
It is clearly a
spontaneous generation of centipedes
right.
in the head.
You know? Right. Clearly, we have a theory about we have a hypothesis about how it could have ended up in there, and then a story of how it ended up coming out.
It's about to get weirder. Guess what the reporting physician recommends as a treatment for centipede sinus?
I don't know, blowing one's nose?
Nope. Monsieur Littre, who related the story, advises in all such stubborn cases as will not submit to either external or internal means to come to the trepan, which may be employed with all safety. That's right, trepanning. If the insect won't come out – now, we've talked about trepanning on the podcast before. What's going on here? You bring out the drill.
That's right. We're talking – usually the idea would be, oh, we're going to drill a hole in the skull to relieve pressure.
Yeah.
Relieve you of your symptoms. But I guess this is the idea of like, okay, it needs – that centipede needs out of your head. It's not coming out through the naturally occurring gateways. We shall make a new gateway in the head for the centipede.
Right. I mean, this is almost like the centipede is kind of taking the role of the stone of madness in the medieval form here. Though, again, I want to allow I feel this is unlikely. It's not impossible a lady had a centipede in her sinus. He also recommends using oil and acrid plants to force it out. That maybe seems more reasonable.
Yeah, I would be like, let's try that first.
Yeah.
Let's check those off the list first.
Okay, that's not all. I feel like who's the game show host who says that's not all? You're going to get more prizes.
I don't know. The Cat in the Hat says that, but
I'm
quite a game show host.
The Cat in the Hat. I'll be the Cat in the Hat and say, that's not the last of the centipedes up the noses. We got more for you, including with more tobacco association, so with the snuff. A third case documented right alongside the first one in this source from the 18th century, Monsieur Malot reported that one of the king's household troops complained for 3 years of an acute pain in the left frontal sinus, which extended to the eye of the same side, so as to endanger his losing it. He had also a buzzing noise in his ear, to relieve which he had some oil of sweet almonds put into it, and in 2 days after he perceived in his left nostril an itching and stinging as if something moved there, which he could not discharge, but by putting his finger into his nose, when behold he pulled out a worm which ran swiftly on the palm of his hand, though covered with a viscous matter and snuff, of which this gentleman took plenty. This worm was put into a tobacco box with snuff in it, where it lived 5 or 6 days. All the patient's complaints ceased after this worm came away. The only difference between this and the former is this. This worm was 6 lines only long and had but 100 feet. But there was this singular in both cases. The former was thought to be expelled by the use of tobacco snuff, whereas this subsisted 3 years with a plentiful use of the same weed, and after its expulsion, lived 5 or 6 days on the same.
All right, so the idea here is that the centipede lived for years in this guy's head because he kept putting snuff in there and it was eating the snuff.
It seems to be at least partially the implication. Okay. I don't know about eating the snuff. There seem to be multiple reasons to doubt the story, especially if you're taking on that detail about the last one, like surviving by eating tobacco. Tobacco, of course, contains nicotine, which is a powerful poison. Like so many of the drugs that humans consume on purpose recreationally, nicotine is supposed to discourage animals from consuming the plant. And this is one of the reasons nicotine can be used as a natural pesticide. However, I do want to take a really brief digression just to point out one fascinating creature I came across here that does survive on tobacco and nicotine, and that is the Manduca sexta. Robert, do you know about this one?
No, I wasn't familiar with the Manduca sexta.
Oh, this is great. So this is a moth of the Sphingidae family, and in its larval stage, so meaning as a caterpillar, this species is sometimes known as the tobacco hornworm. So the tobacco hornworm eats the leaves of the tobacco plant, and the hornworm has a special gene called CYP6B46 that allows it to metabolize nicotine. And now there's a twist. It doesn't just metabolize the nicotine. It uses this tobacco in its diet to produce a chemical defense, sometimes referred to in the literature as toxic halitosis. It's killer tobacco breath. And so when the hornworm is threatened by a predator, like a wolf spider, it can defend itself by releasing nicotine through pores in its skin, which drives away the predator. And this has been confirmed by research that found that hornworms fed on low nicotine food were more susceptible to being attacked by wolf spiders. But at the same time, I do not think that a tobacco hornworm was in this guy's sinus.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. There's a big difference between this larva that is clearly it has evolved to feed on the leaves of this plant versus the predator that is the centipede.
Okay, so we got doubts about all these reports, but that's three centipede in the nose reports now. You know what? I found one more old centipede in the nose report. This one from the Journal of Laryngology and Otology by W.P. Meyjes. I don't know how to pronounce that, but I think this is a report from Amsterdam, and this is from 1898. And this report goes, a woman farm worker from the countryside appeared to the physician with the complaint of a headache over the right eye that had persisted for months, combined with a chronic runny nose. The doctor did not immediately detect any major problems, except for stuff like swelling in the nasal cavity and conjunctivitis, or, you know, inflammation of the eyes. So to help lessen the swelling go down, the doctor ordered menthol with boric acid for the woman to snuff up. Man, every time you read these, you're just like, wow, these old treatments are boric acid. But so she snuffed it up. A few days later, the woman returned. After she has snuffed up the menthol and the boric acid, she has a fit of sneezing and, quote, found in her handkerchief a small insect still alive. She had put it in some brandy and took it to me. The insect, which was about 7 millimeters long, turned to be a centipede. Centipede, of course, is not an insect, but this report says after the centipede was sneezed out, all the woman's symptoms went away. So it's difficult to tell how much stock we should put into these stories about centipedes in the human body. Apparently, like reported by physicians to real medical journals and publications, and unfortunately, as we will explore in the rest of this episode, it is not in principle impossible for insects, centipedes, and other small creatures to get inside a person's cranial cavities. That does happen, and we'll discuss more later. At the same time, these stories, at least some of them, seem kind of suspicious for the quality of how long the centipede was supposedly alive inside the human. Maybe not impossible, but it's definitely questionable. They also, to me at least, I don't know if you got the same feeling, Robert, they call to mind the story of Mary Toft, the 18th century Englishwoman and first-class hoax artist who had doctors and surgeons convinced that she was repeatedly giving birth to rabbits.
Oh, yes. I remember this story. Yes.
Apparently, she really damaged some medical reputations because she had some guys on the line saying like, oh, yeah, I saw it. This lady gave birth to like rabbit parts and like part of an eel and parts of a cat.
Which, if nothing else, shows you, like, here's an example, like, somebody's willing to go through the grossness of producing, say, part of a rabbit from their body as a hoax. So putting a centipede up your nose, really, it's a lighter sentence.
Or, I mean, in some cases, all you'd have to do is show up with the centipede in a handkerchief or in a bottle of brandy, and say, this came out of my nose. Now, why people would really be compelled to do that, I don't know. But then again, people have all kinds of crazy reasons for doing stuff. I mean, people just like to make up weird stories sometimes.
Yeah, could just be for the sheer attention of the thing.
Yeah. Then again, I don't want to totally discount the full nature of these stories because there are also modern reports of centipedes in body cavities. Some tend to be reported with like an air of sensationalism that kind of prejudices me against just accepting them. For example, in 2015, KATV, a local news station in Arkansas, reported that a 14-year-old boy in Saline County woke up with terrible pain in one of his ears. He reached into his ear, pulled out a 4-inch-long centipede. The family reportedly put the centipede in a plastic bag and took the boy to the emergency room. He was okay, and the hospital reported they had never encountered a centipede in an ear before. I guess nothing about that story is really implausible, except that it always gets picked up by, like, the Daily Mail, and that's how you see it. And so that sort of prejudices me against it. But for the record, I tried to find recently documented cases of centipedes in the nasal cavity and couldn't find anything, though I did find reports of centipedes in the human ear. So it seems like if centipedes do get up in the sinuses, up in the nose, it's much more rare for that to happen than for other cranial invasions, such as, say, cockroaches in the ear, which we'll get to later.
All right, on that note, we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right, we're back. So we've discussed centipedes crawling around in one's head, allegedly. What parts of the human body are we going to next, Joe?
Well, I think we should take a foray into the oral cavity.
Okay.
So let's establish some basic facts here. First of all, the question, can bugs get inside your body cavities? The answer is yes.
Yes.
That can happen. It does sometimes happen.
Right. If anything, we need more bugs in our mouths because we should be eating more bugs.
Oh, well, that's a totally different question.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're on the record being pro-entomophagy here, but not talking about the mouth cavity so much because that's less of a worry, right? Unless the bug is poisonous, if you swallow it, you know, it's just protein.
Problem solved.
It's it's going to be digested. The problem would really be if it's in a cavity that is not meant to accept incoming solid matter.
Ah, so this is where we're getting into the ear.
Yes, exactly. And so it's time to talk about cockroaches because cockroaches are apparently one of the most common animals to end up in human orifices in real documented cases. I was reading a National Geographic article about this by Erica Engelhaupt, and she cites an interview with a North Carolina State University entomologist named Kobe Shawl. A few of Shawl's quotes and insights. Of course, first of all, it's not uncommon for a cockroach to show up in the human ear. That just does happen. People show up at hospitals all the time with a cockroach lodged in their ear. Apparently, the nose is much more unusual. This is like a less common thing to find, but also not totally unknown. Why cockroaches? Well, Shawl says cockroaches are constantly searching for food, and actually earwax might be an attractive source of nutrition to them. Earwax tends to contain microbiota that emit a particular kind of volatile compound, volatile fatty acids. And these airborne compounds are similar to what might be present in meat. So your earwax might smell like meat to a hungry cockroach.
Crawl into those meat caves.
It's like
go of that that meat wax.
Yeah, straight to the butcher shop, get you some gabagool in the ear. Earbagool. Shawl suggests it's possible that secretions from the nasal passage might also be appealing as a kind of food to cockroaches. I don't know for sure, but it's possible. But it's also worth emphasizing that cockroaches are not parasites. They're not like hookworms. They're not like the human botfly. It is not in their interest to get stuck inside a human body cavity.
Right. That is a, it's an extreme environment best left to the specialists.
Right. So when a cockroach ends up in a human ear or even in a nose, it is generally all just a big misunderstanding. They didn't really want to get stuck in there. They don't want to be inside you. They'd rather be somewhere else, but it just happened. They were hungry.
Now, that being said, one can well imagine that this could be a path, a long path to parasitism in an organism, such as, say, the theories regarding the emergence of vampire bats that they may have once feasted on. In larva that might be present at a wound site on some sort of megafauna.
Mm-hmm.
And then over time, that develops into a more strategic consumption of blood directly from the large herbivore as opposed to drinking the blood, eating the body of the parasites that prey upon the large herbivore.
So an evolutionary path over like millions of years,
right, yeah.
Not over like a night or a year.
Yeah, nowhere we're going to get tomorrow and nowhere that we have arrived yet.
Oh, that is an interesting evolutionary path though, the path from say like a cleaning mutualism to parasitism.
But it would have to be a situation – like the thing about it is for the cockroach, especially in a human – habitat,
mm-hmm.
There's plenty to eat. There are plenty of other things to eat, like the ear wax. If it were a great source of sustenance, it's probably not the best source of sustenance for the creature.
Well, even so, it probably might just smell like sustenance.
Yeah.
So almost all incursions of roach kind into human orifices happen while the human is asleep. They almost never happen while the person's awake. And they also almost always feature small specimens of the creature involved. You don't tend to get a giant cockroach in your ear. You get a little juvenile cockroach in
your ear. Not one of those movie or zoo cockroaches.
Movie or zoo? What do you mean?
Because you're watching a movie or you go to the zoo, you're probably going to encounter one of those giant hissing cockroaches.
Yeah.
And then likewise, if it's a film about cockroaches, sometimes they'll throw one of those in just because some people keep them as pets and they're more they're just grosser looking.
There's a 0% chance you'll get a giant hissing cockroach in your ear.
Yes.
If you get one, it'll be a little one, you know, not as big a deal. But also, while bugs can get inside the human body, sometimes most of the reports and images of this you see on the internet are fake. We want to emphasize this. You'll see this on social media. You'll see reports in the tabloids, spiders crawling under people's skin, burrowing into wounds and all that. It's pretty much all fake. Cockroaches really do get into ears, but almost every image you see on the internet is not real. Likewise, a lot of the reports you read on the internet, especially from kind of viral sources, mm-hmm. they're not real either. One common example is, I don't know, Robert, have you ever come across the story of like ants getting in through the ear and eating the brain?
I don't think I have, but that does sound like the kind of thing you might read in a foreword from grandma or something.
Exactly. They get in the ear and eat the brain if you like eat sweets before going to bed, or they crawl in one ear and crawl out the other ear. These things do not happen. There are no records in the medical literature of anything like this happening, and it doesn't make sense on its face. Insects do sometimes go in the ear, but they don't eat the brain. They don't infest the deeper cranium. That just doesn't happen. But it's easy to see why stories like this, the untrue stories especially about like spiders crawling under the skin or ants getting in through the ear and eating the brain and all that kind of thing, why they are very popular and clicky and shareable, and why they take hold of the public consciousness, why they become entomological folklore, because I think they ping a very sensitive spot in our neurology, that mm-hmm. like there's a certain part of human nature that seems very finely tuned for recognizing parasitism and creepy crawlies and anything that might be getting on you, because there are real parasites out there.
Right.
So we're sort of hyper primed, I think, to make monsters within this category.
Right. And sometimes we overtly make monsters of them too. Let's not count out the role that horror plays in all of this.
Like, oh, yeah.
In thinking of this, how many of you thought back to Stephen King's Creepshow
mm-hmm.
and the scene where all the cockroaches burst out of E.G. Marshall.
That's a great one.
Yeah, and a whole bit that's about like fear of creepy crawlies and cockroaches, you know. And then we have all these stories too of like vampires dying and bursting into, a wave of centipedes and bugs.
Yeah. Well, E.G. Marshall, I think he plays like a Howard Hughes type character,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
He's like a rich guy who keeps himself secluded because he's afraid of like bugs and germs and everything.
Right. And there's also, I think, with this innate fear of our body being a habitat for something. And granted, our bodies are habitats. We learn more about that essential nature of our being every day. But it's part of the horrors of the grave, and the idea that things would be living within us while we were alive is grotesque.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, your body needs to be a habitat for your microbiome. You don't want it to be a habitat for other larger creatures.
Right.
And so while it is not impossible for bugs to get inside human body cavities, like there are cases where it definitely happens. Oh, yes, we will discuss more before this episode is over. Many, and I'd say probably the vast majority of cases in which someone is convinced they have bugs inside their body are cases of what's known as delusional infestation, also known as delusional parasitosis, or sometimes as Ekbom syndrome.
Yeah, named for Swedish neurologist Carl Axel Ekbom, who published seminal accounts of the disease in 1937, 1938.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, the idea here is that, one comes to believe that parasites are infesting your home, your surroundings, your clothing, and ultimately your body.
Now, of course, these reports are not isolated to real actual parasites like hookworms and, you know, that kind of thing. It also includes delusional ideas about insects and other creatures that are not actually parasites.
Right. And very often the way it ends up going is someone feels that they are infested by something. You know, they feel that they have parasites inside their body, in their bowels, under their skin. There's some sort of an itching sensation, et cetera. And then they go to the doctor and the doctor looks at them and says, no, there's nothing. There's nothing there. But they know. They feel it. They believe it. And they begin going down this road of trying to figure out what's wrong. But it, of course, ultimately, it is not a problem. It's not a dermatological problem. It's not a medical, a biological problem. It is a psychological problem. It is a delusion.
Mm-hmm.
So you see this sometimes in the cases of stimulant abuse, especially methamphetamine abuse. It can result in delusional parasites. Sometimes you've seen these referred to as cocaine bugs or, you know, the ideas of tweakers who pick at their skin in search of the bugs that they feel in their skin.
Mm-hmm.
The Bohart Museum of Entomology points out that high fevers and severe alcohol withdrawal can also produce these symptoms, along with visual hallucinations of the bugs in question.
Oh, wow.
I should also point out there's a wonderful, I don't know if wonderful is the word for it. There's a play.
A powerful
play by Tracy Letts that I actually got to see performed locally here in Atlanta. It was really good, called Bug.
Uh-huh.
And it was later made into a 2006 film by William Friedkin starring Ashley Judd, Michael Shannon, and Harry Connick Jr.
Harry Connick Jr.?
Yeah. I don't know who he played. I haven't seen the film version. But I know that the two main characters are Judd and Shannon in the film. But it's quite good. There's a lot of skin in it, a lot of bug delusions. And it begins with conspiracy theories about the infestation of the room or the apartment that they're staying in. And then they end up having the shared delusion of their bodies being infested by some sort of a parasite. Anyway, that's the fiction. But the fiction does line up reasonably well with some of the realities. The delusion can ultimately result in self-mutilation as one attempts to remove the bugs or as one excessively scratches at the skin.
Uh-huh.
There's actually a wonderful article that came out about this a couple of years ago from Eric Boodman, and he actually won a 2018 Science and Society Journalism Award for his article, Accidental Therapists: For Insect Detectives, the Trickiest Cases Involve the Bugs That Aren't Really There, published in STAT. He describes an individual suffering from this delusion who consulted an exterminator. Then they consulted their doctor, and then they went to a dermatologist. And each time they weren't getting the answers that they wanted and then they needed. Each time they were told, you know, there are no bugs in your house. There are no bugs in your skin. Ultimately, they took to filling a bathtub up with insecticide and climbing into it.
Oh, no.
But even that didn't solve it. They got out and they still felt the presence of the bugs. And that's where, as Boodman explains in his article, that's where Dr. Gail Ridge entered the scenario. A public entomologist, meaning people come to her with specimens and questions to the tune of like 23 people a day. And she works at the Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station. So this individual came to her and she tried to explain, no, look, this is how insects actually interact with your skin. This is how, you know, actual parasites work. And she ended up seeing the individual a handful of times before she learned that they died.
Oh, no.
So in this case and others, Dr. Ridge here often has to weigh in on cases that are far more psychological than entomological.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Now, Boodman's paper is a great read. I'll try to include a link to it on the landing page for this episode at the website, stufftoblowyourmind.com. But it makes a number of very interesting points. First of all, these patients are really suffering, even though doctors tend to, in many cases, dismiss them and send them away.
Right. Like if you show up at a doctor's office and you say, I've got bugs inside my body, and then the doctor just checks and says, no, there are no bugs in there. That shouldn't be case closed, right? That
right.
should be like there should be a sign that something is wrong, that you do need help in a way, even if there aren't physically insects.
But it's a difficult scenario because the best treatment for their suffering is usually an antipsychotic. But the problem, the struggle is getting them to accept that their problem is psychological and that they need to see a mental health professional because they're coming in here. They believe that only a powerful anti-parasitic is going to do the trick and or that an insect specialist is required. Quote, Ridge sees as many as 200 of these cases a year. She isn't the only one with this unintentional expertise. A whole network of entomologists at universities, research stations, and even at natural history museums is all too familiar with these requests.
Wow.
So they come in, they bring scabs, samples of skin as proof. One of the individuals that Boodman talks to is Nancy Hinkle from the University of Georgia at Athens, so close by here. And Hinkle says that inquiries like this take up 20% of her time and that every state has, quote, somebody like Gail or me. Like
wow.
There's somebody in there that this is becoming increasingly their work.
Yeah.
In other words, cases of delusional parasitosis are rare in the medical field but far more common in the entomological world. Extreme cases may end in severe alteration of one's life, even suicide or death. Here's one more quote from the article. Quote, even when an entomologist notices the telltale signs of DP, there is little that can be done over the phone. Biologists estimate that there are some 6.8 million arthropod species on Earth. Even the most fanciful description could, at its root, be a real insect.
Well, that's sort of like what we're running into with the cases of the centipedes up earlier. Mm-hmm. Like, we're not there to see it, so we don't really know for sure. We're just reading these accounts, and so we're stuck with saying, like, I don't know. I don't think this likely happened, but we can't be sure. I mean, you can't rule it out.
Right. So part of the problem identified in this article is that what's needed here are psychodermatology outposts in the medical world where the connection between the science of the mind and science of the skin is more established so that there's greater ease and finesse moving patients toward proper psychological treatments. And there apparently are a few places in the United States and some in the Netherlands that have begun to do this. One of the accounts that the author includes here mentions a doctor in Amsterdam that deals with patients, and they've sort of figured out how to, you know, first form a relationship of trust with the patient, and then at the appropriate time, you know, let them know, like, this is something you need to see a psychiatrist about, and sometimes sweetening the deal by pointing to a 2014 paper about how some drugs that treat delusional disorders also happen to kill parasites. So I think that's interesting, you know, figuring out that like there are more of these cases occurring than one might think. And if medical professionals, entomologists, et cetera, are better positioned to move them towards, encourage them to go seek appropriate help, everyone's going to be better off.
Yeah, absolutely. Though, I mean, this is such a hard problem. And it's also part of a broader problem, which is present in the medical and mental health communities where it's it just tends to be a fact that people who are experiencing delusions and psychosis, most of the conditions that cause them to experience delusions and psychosis also tend to entail ideation patterns that make people resistant to correct diagnosis. So like you tell a person that, okay, you know, what you think you're experiencing is not physically the case and, you know, like antipsychotic medication could help you. It just tends very often to be the case that people don't respond well to being told that and they say, no, that's not right.
Right, yeah, and then oftentimes there's a stigma against seeking professional help for mental problems or having any kind of mental disorder or delusion.
Yeah.
And then again, back to just the nature of insects infesting our homes, like how hard are fleas to see? How hard are chiggers to see?
Right.
Without getting into just the whole list of various parasitic organisms that are basically invisible to us. So again, it doesn't – I mean, if one is presented with the option, like, well, either other people just can't see this creature because it's small or other people can't see this creature because it is a delusion of your mind, you can see why people are more inclined to believe that it's just something that they just haven't found the right entomologist. They haven't found the right dermatologist to identify the problem.
Yeah, well, I guess we'd certainly hope that by, like, establishing procedures like this where you've got sort of a chain of people to talk to where you establish trust with the patient and by trying to remove stigma from seeking mental health help, that maybe this kind of thing could get better. I don't know. I would hope so.
Yeah. Yeah, because according to what I've read, the antipsychotic medications do help the individuals.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, there is a treatment.
Yeah.
It's not one of these, because there are certain mental conditions we've discussed, various delusions, where there is not really an exit, you know, that where things are pretty dire. But this seems to be something that is in many cases very treatable, again, if proper treatment is found.
And again, I get the sense, I don't know if this lines up with what you're reading, but I get the sense that the vast majority of the people who show up and say, I've got a bug in me, do not actually have a bug in them.
Like, correct,
The psychological cause of these symptoms, I mean, the symptoms are real in both cases, but the psychological causes are far more prevalent than the entomological causes.
Absolutely. All right, we're going to take another break, give you a few minutes to listen to an advertisement and maybe feel your skin a little bit. See how you're feeling, but we'll be right back with more tales of bugs in the skin and bugs of the mind.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year. Equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
All right, we're back. So as we were just discussing, it's clear that the majority of cases where people think they've got like a bug inside a body cavity or under their skin or something, and if you think you've got bugs under your skin, you're pretty much always going to be wrong. If you think you have a bug in the body cavity, even then you're probably mistaken. There's probably not a bug in there. But we can't say that's the case always because sometimes bugs do get in there. So I think it's time to talk about that a little more and about and maybe get to talking about what to do if there actually is a bug in a body cavity. So I came across a 1997 article from the Oxford University Press Journal of the Entomological Society of America, and the piece is by the American biologist and entomologist and National Medal of Science laureate May Barenboim. Just a few interesting facts about Barenboim I found. In addition to being a renowned entomologist, I think she sounds very much like our kind of people. She created an event at the University of Illinois called the Insect Fear Film Festival, which according to its website is an opportunity to, quote, watch insect-themed horror movies, handle live insects at our petting zoo, learn about insects you fear, and then get t-shirts, stickers, balloon insects, and your face painted. This sounds like my kind of event. I would love to go to that.
This sounds great. Yeah, we'll have to look her up.
Creature features and then touch and real insects. Yeah. That sounds wonderful. It sounds like she's very comfortable marrying, you know, sort of like the pop culture, the insect myths and all that, using that as a window to share real knowledge about entomology and the role of insects in our lives with people.
Let's look at the fear, let's look at the sensationalism, and then let's look at the reality.
Yeah, and so she seems very cool. She's also apparently had a character named after her in the classic X-Files episode War of the Coprophages, which is one of the best episodes in the entire series, quite relevant to today's topic because it discusses cockroaches, ideas about cockroach infestation, and delusional infestation or delusional parasitosis, which is a big thing in the episode. The character named after her is apparently is named, and I did remember this character, named Bambi Barenboim.
Ah, nice.
I recall she's sort of like a weird entomologist who Mulder develops a crush on and Scully gets jealous of over the phone. And I recall she also has some theory that UFO sightings are actually caused by swarms of insects. But that's the X-Files character, not the real Dr. Barenboim. So this article, by the way, if you can look it up, it's really pretty great, the one from 1997. So she collects references from the medical literature, including an interesting study from 1987 by Baker, which found 134 cases of foreign objects found in children's ears. Of those 134 objects, 27 were insects, and of those, 21 were cockroaches. So that's 78%. The others, you ask? Well, I actually looked up the study to find out what the others were. The other six of those 27 were one ant, one fly, three spiders, and one tick.
Only one of those has any business being in there. The tick, you can only blame so much because, you know, it's a tick. It's gross. It's there to suck skin.
The tick's actually the worst one. I don't really bear a lot of ill will to cockroaches. I don't love having them in my house, but I, you know, ticks, I just, nuke them.
Yeah, like we discussed in our episode on ticks, that certainly everyone should go back and listen to if you want to feel gross about the woods. You know, they are out to get us. They are out to get us. Most of these other cases are just mistakes.
Yeah.
But the tick wants you and is seeking you. And if you venture into its abode, it will find you.
So Barenboim mentions that a common method for removing cockroaches from the ear is to drown a cockroach in liquid of some kind before removal.
Okay. That is much like my dad did with the bug that flew into my ear.
I think that was a good thing to do. And now, ideally, I'm not going to say people should usually try to deal with bugs in body cavities on their own. Mm-hmm. Because there are cases where having like a medical opinion is important, but that does seem to be a pretty reliable way to deal with it. Drowning liquids throughout medical history have included benzocaine, succinylcholine, isopropyl alcohol, hydrogen peroxide, ether, water, vegetable oil, mineral oil. I want to be clear, I'm not recommending all of those, especially since things like ether are flammable. A more recent technique that's been used in clinics, pioneered in 1980, is the use of lidocaine spray. This is usually used as a topical anesthetic, right? You know, they spray it on you to numb the skin. Mm-hmm. But when applied to a, quote, intraoral cockroach, it tends to paralyze the insect so the insect can be safely removed. Or even better, the initial application of lidocaine solution spray sometimes causes the problem to resolve itself, as in the case of one intervention by O'Toole et al. Published in 1985, in which after the lidocaine application, quote, the roach exited the canal at a convulsive rate of speed and attempted to escape across the floor.
Presumably with a Roadrunner-esque sound effect.
Beep, beep. And then Barenbaum notes that, quote, the simple crush method was, quote, ultimately responsible for the demise of the cockroach.
Oh, but now I got a dead cockroach in my ear.
No, it wasn't in the ear. It was on the floor.
Oh, okay. Whew. So, right. Well, that's fine.
No. I want to be very clear. Don't try to step on a cockroach in somebody's ear. That doesn't work at all. That method was then improved upon in 1989 with the addition of a metal suction tip to vacuum the cockroach out. Reportedly, after one case, the lidocaine spray was applied, and then the patient suddenly exhorted the doctor to, quote, get that sucker out of my ear. So they used the vacuum to get it out. But then also she relays some reports about fly larvae or maggots colonizing the orifices of humans, such as the nose or the urogenital tract, though she seems a little skeptical about the case report that that was about the urogenital tract. One of the medical reports she discusses, relayed by Badia and Lund in the Journal of Laryngology and Otology in 1994, concerns this 35-year-old man in London who had an infestation of Oestrus ovis, a sheep nasal botfly, in his nose, in the 35-year-old man's nose. Apparently, this happens more commonly in shepherds and people who deal directly with sheep. That makes sense. It's a little perplexing how this guy in London got one. He claimed he had nothing to do with sheep, but who knows? According to the report, he had been, quote, sneezing out several maggots during the preceding 6 weeks before he called a doctor. And Barenbaum points out that it's kind of odd that it took him that long to call a doctor after sneezing out maggots.
I would also think if you seem to be consistently sneezing out maggots, you do have a small window to really succeed on the sideshow circuit, you know?
Yeah.
Like the second it starts happening, book some appearances and do it as fast as possible while the magic is still there.
Come see the amazing maggot geek. And perhaps the most troubling recent case, and don't worry, it has a happy ending, of a cockroach in a body cavity that I came across was this one. So on February 1st, 2017, a Dr. M.N. Shankar of Stanley Medical College Hospital in Chennai, India, removed a cockroach from a woman's skull, and this one was in her sinus cavity. So here's a definite, like, this is earlier centipede territory, right? We don't know if there were ever really centipedes in there, but definitely a cockroach can get in there. It was in her sinus cavity in between her eyes, and it had apparently crept up her nose while she was asleep. And fortunately, Dr. Shankar was able to remove the insect successfully with an endoscopic procedure, and the woman was fine. If you've got a strong stomach, there's a video of this you can watch on the internet.
Well, no thank you. But secondly, it does make me think of the little old woman who lived in the shoe. Uh-huh. So if centipedes are not naturally crawling into people's sinus cavities, but if occasionally a cockroach may, then perhaps the centipede is just that individual's initial attempt to deal with the problem that doesn't work. And then they have to go to the doctor and they don't, you know, it's like if you try and, you know, work on your own toenail or something or do your own dentistry. And then you go finally and seek professional help. You don't want to tell them, oh, yeah, I tried to do this stupid thing of my own first. And now I'm here with you. No, you just say, I guess there's a cockroach up there.
Did you say the old lady who lived in a shoe? I think you meant
the old lady who
swallowed a fly. Yeah.
It might be the same woman.
She swallowed a centipede to catch the fly. She snorted a centipede to catch the cockroach that wriggled and jiggled and wiggled and side roach.
Perhaps she'll die. Yes. Yeah.
But she didn't. Well, no, wait. I'm not saying this woman actually did that. But the woman in the case, I want to be very clear, did not die.
Oh, okay.
If the
I was talking about the old lady who swallowed the fly. Okay.
I don't remember what happened to her.
I think she died.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Well, so I think we should end here with a discussion of what to do if you actually think there's a bug in one of your body cavities, if you think you've got a centipede or a cockroach up your nose or in your ear or whatever, what's your plan of action? So first of all, we want to emphasize again, even if you feel very convinced, there is a very good chance you're mistaken. And that should be good news, right? Like, people feel creepy, crawly sensations for all kinds of reasons. And animals actually getting inside the body cavities, though there are a lot of stories collected of it over the time, the chances of it happening to you are pretty rare, especially if you don't live in a tropical climate.
Right. Now, I do want to stress everything we said earlier about delusional parasitosis. If you do have substance abuse issues, that could be part of the problem. But you shouldn't be afraid to see a doctor over the symptoms if that's the case. But your symptoms could be quite unrelated to any kind of substance abuse issues. And in this case, it's really important to realize that it is treatable with antipsychotic medication. And cases like this are not as rare as you might think. Though, obviously, again, I can see where that could be a struggle to realize, you know, okay, it's not a situation of an insect crawling into my skin or into my body. It's a more elusive concept. There's a delusion in my mind that has to be addressed.
If the causes are psychological, there is not shame in seeking treatment. Seeking right. treatment will help you.
Absolutely. So that's what you should do.
Right.
What should you not do?
Oh, okay. Well, whatever the real cause is, if you think something is in your ear, say, or in your nose, first piece of advice is do not try to kill or crush it.
Yes.
because if there actually is an insect in there, you're not seriously in danger of a bug inside your nose or your ear eating your brain. That's not going to happen. You should seek medical attention as soon as possible, but it's not going to eat the contents of your skull. What you're actually in greater danger of is bacterial infection in the cavity. And I mentioned earlier that article that interviews the entomologist Kobe Schall. Schall points out that one of the worst ways you can put yourself at risk of infection with a roach in your orifice is to crush it, because this could release its mighty legions of gut bacteria into your own body, and that can lead to an infection.
And there's a wonderful historic example of this.
Yeah. So I want to talk about the English explorer and British Indian Army officer John Hanning Speke, who was famous for exploring the Nile River to find what was believed to be its source in the 1850s. And there's this story related in Speke's diaries that one night he's resting in his tent, and the tent, quote, became covered with a host of small black beetles, evidently attracted by the glimmer of the candle. And then he went to sleep, even though all these beetles were around, and he later woke up with one of the beetles crawling in his ear. Quote, "He began with exceeding vigor, like a rabbit in a hole, to dig violently away at my tympanum. The queer sensation this amusing measure excited in me is past description. What to do, I knew not." So Speke tried to get it out by washing his ear canal with melted butter. This didn't work. Then he tried to dig it out with a knife, and this was a bad move. He only killed and presumably crushed or cut up the insect and wounded his own ear, and then the ear became infected. Quote, "For many months, the tumor made me almost deaf and ate a hole between the ear and the nose."
Ugh.
"So that when I blew it, my ear whistled so audibly that those who heard it laughed. 6 or 7 months after this accident happened, bits of the beetle, a leg, a wing, or parts of the body, came away in the wax." And I should just mention that I actually found the story related in that classic Snopes article about bugs eating through the ear into the brain. So that's where I got the quotes from. But they're originally from, Speke's diaries as passed along in a book about Sir Richard Francis Burton, right?
Yeah. This is just one of many amazing incidents from the travels of John Hanning Speke and Captain Sir Richard Francis Burton, with whom he sought the source of the Nile.
Mm-hmm.
And the bug incident here is actually depicted in the 1990 film The Mountains of the Moon, which starred Patrick Bergen as Richard Francis Burton and Ian Glynn, who most people know as Sir Mormont from Game of Thrones.
Yeah, Jorah the Andal.
Yeah, he played John Hanning Speke.
Hmm.
I haven't seen it in forever. I saw it when I was a kid and loved it. But it also stars Richard E. Grant, Fiona Shaw, Peter Vaughn, Delroy Lindo, Bernard Hill, Omar Sharif. So it had a great cast, and I remember it being quite an interesting film and a great introduction to two just fascinating characters from history.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to mention quickly that it's impossible to be sure. Like, we don't know what actually caused Speke's infection, but it seems very likely that simultaneously crushing the insect and cutting his own ear with the knife made the problem much worse than it would have been if he just let the beetle try to get out, and then that probably may have led to an infection.
Yeah, after you brought this up, I popped out Edward Rice's biography of Burton. And he mentions that Burton sometimes criticized Speke for a bit of like reckless ambition, especially in the African wilds. But then again, the two clashed at times and had a tremendous falling out and somewhat hated each other later on in life. But at any rate, one assumes that Burton was not tremendously easy to get along with either. But at any rate, if you want to see a cinematic depiction of this beetle in the ear incident, it is in that movie, The Mountains of the Moon. Along with one of the other more harrowing encounters they had, is also depicted in which Somali spearmen tie up and stab Speke numerous times with their spears, and then a thrown spear skewers Burton through the cheeks, through one cheek and out the other.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah, you see all these like later portraits of Burton, and you can often see the scar on each side of the face.
Ooh, that's like a Guillermo del Toro movie injury. That's like it's in Pan's Labyrinth where the guy gets cheek trauma.
Oh yeah, well this is a classic case of cheek trauma. Well, not only cheek trauma, but also dental trauma because the spear took out teeth and damaged the jaw. Ooh. But he was able to. They both traveled back to England after the incident, and both had lots of medical care tend to their wounds.
Well, yeah. So I guess the moral of the story here is don't be like Speke. If you actually do think you have a cockroach or an insect in your ear or whatever, don't crush it. Don't kill it. Do your best to stay calm. Seek medical attention as soon as possible. A doctor can examine you and tell if something is actually in there or not. And if there is, they can try to remove the animal if it's actually there. If there's not something in there, you should seek medical attention too. They can try to help figure out what's going on and possibly prescribe medication to alleviate your symptoms.
All right, so there you have it. Obviously, if you have any experience with any of these scenarios yourself, or if you just have heard some folk tales of such things, or you have a favorite cinematic intrabody bug threat you want to share, let us know. You can reach us in the normal ways. First of all, go to our mothership, stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find all the episodes. That's where you'll find links out to various social media accounts where you can interact with us. And if you're on Facebook, try joining the Facebook group, the Stuff to Blow Your Mind discussion module. It's a great place to chat with other listeners and sometimes with us.
Hey, and if you haven't subscribed to our other podcast yet, it's called Invention. You should definitely go check that out. You can get it wherever your podcasts are found. And if you like this show, you'll probably like that one. We bring the same kind of curiosity and approach that we take to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. We apply it to techno history, looking at one invention at a time. So check it out. Subscribe if you haven't. Huge thanks, as always, to our wonderful audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.